Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mdiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And for today, it is a Friday, which means we are focusing on the economy. And this week, we had some bad news, perhaps not completely unexpected, but we heard from StatsSA that we are in a recession at the moment. And then at the same time, the coronavirus does continue to be a risk on the country together with the global markets. So to help us unpack some of these issues, we are joined in studio by Sifiso Skenjana, who is the chief economist at IQ Business. Sifiso, how are you, man?
Great, thanks. And yourself?
I'm all right. Thank you so much for joining us. Just to start the discussion, when we say recession, I guess now we can go back to, you know, economics 101, right? What do people mean when we say we're now in recession?
So we currently observe the country's capacity to produce and the country's national income on a quarter-on-quarter basis.
Yeah.
And so, when we talk about GDP, in essence, it's, as it explains itself, right, is the gross domestic product. And so it's a measure of the national income that we generated. And so when we look at then that number, you know, compare it from one quarter to another, we start to observe a trend. And when you start to see, I guess, a declining trend that happens in two consecutive quarters, and that means you've got negative growth in two consecutive quarters, and then that's what we like to term a technical recession.
Yeah. So what does that actually mean, I guess, for people in the country, and I guess how outsiders view South Africa? I understand that, for example, the bond market has a lot of foreign interest in it. Yeah. Does that affect us in any way?
So it's been quite interesting to observe the fact that, usually when your inflation trajectory is down, your bond yields follow suit. And so that's the return that investors expect from your long-term bonds. And the inverse has been happening. Well, you know, we saw inflation going down as low as 3.6 last year, and I think it averaged about 4.1.
Yeah.
We saw, our long-term bonds not following suit. And I think that's a true testament, I think, of the loss of credibility of our institutions from investors. They don't believe the numbers that we put in as the numbers that reflect the country's capacity to grow.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you look at, for example, how we started last year, the first state of the nation, we said we expected growth to come in at 1.5. Percent, and by the end of the year, you know, we'd revise growth three times downwards yeah. to 0.3. And you look at what happened at the start of this year, the ratings agencies came out, as well as the IMF. So Moody's, for example, said they expect growth for South Africa to be 0.7.
Mm.
And we said we expect growth to be 0.9.
Yeah.
Again, these are some of the things that I think, are showing a bit of a disconnect between how, global investors are looking at our economy in terms of the quality of the economy and the quality of growth in the economy, as well as how we look at it. And I think, that widening credit spread on the back of the long-term bond yields is certainly a sign that foreign investors don't have as much faith as we've got in our own selves.
Mm. So I guess from the way that you are, explaining the 0.7 versus the 0.9,
yeah.
Does that point to the fact that we might be a bit more, I hate to use, sentiment like this, but I guess, does it mean in South Africa we're a bit more, positive about, whereas global investors are a bit more pessimistic about what their expectations are for South African growth?
Yeah, I think we certainly are probably overconfident about our ability to create growth and bring growth into the economy. If you even reflect on the budget speech that recently, was presented by the Minister of Finance.
Yeah.
You know, there were two big bets in that speech. You know, one was the, wage bill bet, and unions have already come out and said they're waging war. right? Mm. And so to be able to then, you know, pull back 161 billion, I think that number is probably a little bit overconfident. Mm. And we might, you know, be able to pull back some. And even that is a starting point. And I think, you know, we mustn't also kind of beat ourselves too hard, is that as long as we're starting to make progress towards reducing the wage bill, even if we don't ultimately get to that 161 right now or in the next 3 years as budgeted, but as long as we start, you know, we're starting to move in the right direction. And so I think there is, I think, a sense that we are a little bit overconfident about the economy's capacity to sustain itself and its capacity to grow. And I think that's the kind of feedback I think our incumbent leaders ought to be taking back, and to look and say, truly, you know, what is the bitter medicine that we have to take right now that will enable us to be positioned for growth in the medium to long term?
I can imagine the tall task that's you know, facing someone like Tito Mboweni. In the space of about 2 weeks, you've given one of the hardest budgets that, you know, has been given in a while. At the same time, you are presented with this recession status. Even though both things are not really surprising per se, but still hard to take. And at the same time, you are thinking about ratings agencies. I've heard a couple of people saying, you know, perhaps we should cut out the noise of what's going on with ratings agencies and just focus on growth. What are your feelings on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's terribly hard to ignore the noise, primarily because the implications for the economy are stark. But I absolutely agree, and I've, you know, put out some work actually late last year saying that my view is that the ratings decision is paralyzing our decision making, you know, because most of our moves now are a plaster or band-aid effect that we're implementing, and so we're trying to plug this hole, plug that hole, instead of truly starting to position the economy for long-term sustainable growth. And so a lot of the choices then now have got to ask around, what does it mean to grow long-term aggregate output, right? And you can go into the things that are able to grow long-term aggregate output. You know, you've got to look at your human capital, right? And we know we've got an unemployment challenge in South Africa, and 3/4 of our labor force is largely semi-skilled and unskilled, and so already, we're not hearing enough around what does it mean to build capacity into the economy. Those are things that move the long run aggregate output. What does it mean when you've got, you know, I'll make an example of mining. Yeah. When you start mining, you know that the mine has got a limited lifespan.
Yeah.
And so you know at some point that the labor you're absorbing now is going to be destitute at some point. You're going to have to release them. So what are the labor migration strategies that we're putting in place to know that in the next 5 years, we need to start transitioning labor out of a certain space into a certain space so that they remain active agents in the economy?
Yeah.
These are all the things that, you know, are conversations way beyond a ratings decision, but more geared towards really capacity building for the economy in the medium and the long term. And I think those are certainly, you know, where we should be placing most of our emphasis. But as I said, you can't ignore the noise that's got to do with ratings agencies.
And in your, I guess, in your line of work, I'm guessing that there are a lot of people that engage with you, whether, I don't know, public, private sector, whatever. What are the conversations that, I guess, people are having around, you know, this issue of the recession? Are people on the ground in companies, in organizations, actually paying attention to this? Is this an actual concern on the ground for industries? Or is this, once again, one of those economic indicators that people sort of like, okay, fine, that's it, and then they continue with their lives?
You know, one of the discussions I recently had was that actually we'd love to challenge the president to have the next State of the Nation address either in Soweto, in Alex, in Soshanguve, Mamelodi, Mdanzane, primarily to remind the people that all of the things that are spoken about there are their problem, you know, that the growth agenda is everyone's problem. And to also get them closer to the real lived experiences of ordinary South Africans. And, you know, when you look on the ground, you know, and look and say, where are the engines of growth? You know, if you just start last year, for example, a large part of the economic growth that we did see in the quarters that did have positive growth was largely driven because of the leading up to the election season. And so it was, you know, government employment and government expenditure ahead of election season. We tend to see that in general. And outside of that, it was only financial services that was growing as a subsector. And so all that's happened now is that, you know, I guess the chickens have come home to roost when now government is forced to reduce its spending. And all of a sudden you start to see all the other leaks in the bucket, you know. So, you know, we saw in the last quarter, you know, how transport had, you know, the lowest growth since 1993, you know. And then you've got construction, for example, which is a sector that can be largely labor absorbed for semi-skilled and unskilled people, you know, having six quarters of negative growth, you know. And, you know, agriculture, for example, 1996 employed 1.6 million people, and it now employs about 875,000 people.
Yeah.
Yet there are portions or pockets within agriculture, like horticulture, that are job acquisitive, right, and job accretive right now. But in if you're just doing a trend analysis, the system is bleeding jobs. And so, you know, it impacts the ordinary person. It impacts spending capacity of the economy. We know that 60% of our GDP is attributable to household expenditure. And so when, you know, you're starting to see, you know, lower growth coming out, sometimes it can also have almost a spiraling impact when it's particularly happening also on the back of rising unemployment.
So as a last point on this issue of the recession and growth and all that, do you think a move like what the minister is proposing around cutting that public sector wage bill, does that really impact consumption in the economy? Or I guess it impacts, I guess, directly the people that would have gotten that money. But consumption-wise in the economy, is that money just not going to be used on something else?
Well, it depends where the money goes and the multiplier effects that are attributable to where the money goes.
Okay.
Right. And so there's a fiscal multiplier, for example, right? So if you go to, if the money goes to, let's say, an infrastructure project, that has a certain multiplier that may be very different to how consumer spending may drive a particular multiplier.
Yeah.
So I think the net effect, I think, is indeterminate in terms of we don't know how it's going to get reallocated, but there's certainly going to be a subsequent strain on household income, that's for sure. If you know, if it means, I'm just making an example, that you are increasing social security on the back of that, are the households, for example, that then are at loss of that, would they be utilizing the loss of funds in the same way the people in the social security space would be utilizing them? You might find, for example, a larger component of the social security money goes into retail spending, so it's for groceries and transport mostly. Yet when maybe you've got a mature established household, a portion of it might go into, you know, retail spending, a portion of it might go into savings, a portion of it might go into, let's say, school fees or whatever. So the impact may be different depending on how those funds get reallocated.
So as we, I guess, round up the discussion, I wanted us to touch on a topic that unfortunately, you know, keeps coming, it keeps growing. We thought when it first happened, we thought we might just be talking about it for about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. But we're now in March and we're still talking about it. And that is the coronavirus. And this week is especially interesting because yesterday, the first confirmed case was announced by the Department of Health in KZN. How have you seen, you know, this coronavirus impact playing out on your end?
It is quite an interesting one, primarily because of the kind of impact that it's had in terms of global sentiment. You know, we have seen in the past, for example, the H1N1 virus, I think it was called swine flu.
Mm.
And that, you know, I think at the end of it all, I think had fatalities of up to about 250,000
mm.
people. And, you know, looking at the coronavirus, the recovery rates are quite high.
Yeah.
And I think the fatality rate is about 3%, if I'm not incorrect, or 3.something%. And as a result, to date, we've got, I think, close to 4,000 reported deaths.
Mm.
Yet, you know, it's really kind of really, you know, strained the global economy in terms of, you know, manufacturing. Lots of factories have closed. Halted production.
Yep.
A lot of, you know, tourism is about to take a hit. We've already seen Chinese PMI numbers coming out significantly lower. I think they came out about 41 index points and had previously been at 50, above 50 index mm-hmm. points. We saw the APSA PMI numbers again also showing a decline in a South African context.
Yeah.
And so already you're starting to see how that's creating a bit of a crazy impact in the global economy. And so there are supply side implications as well as demand side, because, you know, on the demand side is that, you know, people don't want to go out and eat.
Yeah,
people don't want
yeah.
to go to gyms. Yeah. People don't want to be at airports.
Mm.
And that also then has an implication on consumption levels in the economy. And, you know, we've seen, for example, the US coming in with an emergency rate cut of 50 basis points.
Mm.
You know, and the last time they'd done that was, you know, during the financial crisis. You know, and that's them trying to bring some relief into the economy and almost encourage spending. And so they're solving for the one side, which is the demand side problem that may be as a result of this coronavirus. It's hard to solve for the supply side, but even that, as I said, that it may or may not solve for those challenges. And of course, usually what happens when there's, of course, you know, a bit of turmoil in a global context, emerging markets take a hit, you know, and so people run to the reserve currencies. And you know, one of the kind of the benefits that I guess has probably shored up our currency a little bit is the fact that on the back of the interest rate decrease by the, you know, Federal Bank of the US, because then that made South African year bonds a lot more attractive for
yep.
investors. And that's why, you know, we are, on the back of that, we saw, you know, our currency re-strengthen. But the US dollar is supposed to strengthen and, you know, emerging markets take a big hit.
Mm. Now, one of the things that has actually been interesting to me, just looking at the coronavirus, I guess I could think of this in isolation, just because there's so many factors that are involved, is this issue of age. Because we often hear that the majority of that by 2030, you know, depending on some estimates, that the majority of the youth population around the world is in Africa and all of that stuff, which also points to you have aging populations in China and places like the United States and Europe. And if you have a disease that is, you know, wiping, yes, the recovery rates are higher,
mm-hmm.
but where it does affect, I feel like it does prompt some type of conversation just around when you have an aging population, what type of strain does that put on national healthcare resources? You know, if a significant number of, I guess, older people was to become infected, their rates of recovery are likely to be, you know, much less.
Yeah.
And because of, Medicaid in the States and all of those state-sponsored programs, it just makes you wonder that fiscally, how do countries actually afford, you know, these things? Might not necessarily be about the coronavirus, but just generally, I feel like it does prompt that conversation just around healthcare and all of that stuff. Any thoughts on your end just around any of those issues?
We keep joking, but not joking, that, you know, a growth market is the aging population market. And mm-hmm. so I think, you know, caregiving as a as an economic contribution is probably going to start growing over time.
Mm.
Primarily because of these developed markets, we've got large aging populations,
yeah.
And so old age homes become interesting property plays.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's on the one side saying, how does the composition of the economic activity get impacted,
yeah,
by the extent to which your population is aging? We've seen some countries also move to increase the retirement age, primarily because health systems have gotten better in terms of helping people live longer,
mm.
But also that, you know, keeps them taxpayers, yeah, of
yeah.
course. you know, so it's an interesting one around, you know, that you know, portion of the population and their economic activity. They tend to be high value contributors in terms of economic value because they're experienced,
mm.
and so I think that's a real risk for productivity in any economy,
mm.
and when you don't have the young people coming in and innovating,
mm.
and then it's almost, you know, you're looking at this big risk of almost falling off a cliff, you
yeah.
know, of productive activity or knowledge creation falling off a cliff,
mm.
and I think that's what we're probably going to start to see. We're going to start to see a tapering off of the level of investment in R&D, the level of knowledge creation in some of the more developed economies, and we probably going to see the reverse happening in the emerging economies that have got a little bit younger populations, where more of their knowledge economies are going to start growing. And I think that's going to be quite interesting in terms of how it weighs up on the, you know, on the balance of powers in the global marketplace.
Yeah.
So that's certainly, I think, something worth looking at with a keen eye.
Okay, cool. So on the last point, I'm sure you're used to getting this particular question. What's your outlook, I guess, for the rest of the year in light of the conversation we've just had? You've got the recession, this ongoing coronavirus risk. Where are you seeing things, I guess, for the rest of 2020?
I think, you know, first thing, we'd love to encourage the leadership at Eskom to come up and give us rather a load shedding schedule for the year.
Mm, mm,
you know,
mm.
we know the level of demand deficiency is about 2,000 to 3,000 megawatts.
Mm.
And so that's about stage two or stage three. And so if they came out and said, you know, this is the schedule for the rest of the year,
yes.
or the next 18 months, businesses can plan their production around
yes.
that. Everyone, households can plan their activities around that. And I think that's how you want to manage an energy crisis or an energy challenge in the economy, just so that, you know, the uncertainty doesn't continue to be a thorn on everyone's back, and mm. particularly on the economy. And so I think that's the first thing that I think would be a very good move in terms of, you know, stabilizing and bringing some confidence back into the domestic economy. But outside of that, I think, you know, of course, with the coronavirus, we're going to see that, you know, quarter one numbers are going to be materially impacted.
Yeah.
And quarter one is generally a low productivity, a low product a quarter in general. And so I think that's certainly going to come out looking worse than what would have been. And as a result, I think that 0.9% growth expectation is probably yeah. going to get revised. We expect, I think, the inflation trajectory to start moving on the upside, and that might be on the back of you know, weakening currency on mm-hmm. our side,
yeah.
but, you know, and those are all cost push factors, and so it'll be interesting to watch how, you know, the MPC responds to cost push, because, you know, monetary policy is ineffective when you're trying to cool off a cold economy.
Yeah.
you
yeah.
know, so usually you increase your interest rates to cool off the economy
yeah.
when there's some, you know, demand led inflation.
Mm.
You know, so while we expect inflation to inflation is expected to trend down because of lower global demand,
mm.
but I think primarily because of the risks that are being built into our system, I think we can expect more currency weakness. That may have some inflationary effects. If the ratings downgrade takes place, again, that will blow out our currency and that will push up the inflation trajectory. And so I think there's an upside risk to the inflation trajectory, and that will put, again, material strain on households, on businesses. With the December tax statistics, that corporates are now contributing 16.6% to the tax revenue basket, and the previously contributed 18.1%, I think. Yeah. And so you can see corporates are under immense strain. And when I looked at the numbers even in more detail, we found that 57% of the tax that was collected from 380 companies.
That's not a lot.
That's not a lot of companies for 57% of the revenue. And that's against a backdrop of 3.2 million registered companies in, by CIPC, and about 814,000 companies that, I guess, were assessed for tax. So, you know, when you look at that number, that's you know, a really, really scary number around just the top end risk also. To taxing companies that are already under immense amount of strain. Yeah. So I think, you know, we can expect a bit of a challenging year, I think, from the growth front. But, you know, what I'd love to see more of is that at least start to put in place the right infrastructure that will solve for some of the social challenges as well. We know municipal elections are coming up next year, and so we're going into strike season, and so there's going to be, of course, damage of economic infrastructure and some disturbances in economic activity. That's also probably going to put some strain in the economy, and so, you know, it's really now the pressure on the incumbents to try, you know, proactively manage that and come out with a good social project and a developmental project that starts to solve for the inequality challenges that we see remaining pervasive in a South African context. And, you know, from what we hear now from the Deputy Minister of Finance is that only in October will we get a detailed plan for how they're going to solve the youth issue. You know, right now they're working through it. But again, that, you know, the world is not stopping and people are not becoming any less frustrated. And so all of that, I think, coming into one basket is certainly a basket of a challenging year. But, you know, in those kinds of economies, there's always opportunity. And I think the guys who are able to spot the gaps and spot the opportunities for those green shoots, you know, will come out, you know, very strong on the back of South African recovery.
Okay. So that's been us with Sifiso Skenjana, who is the chief economist at IQ Business. Some very interesting, you know, talking points coming out from the discussion, particularly around the recession. We also touched on the coronavirus. He's actually talking about the fact that because of the emergency rate cut in the United States, that's actually made South African bonds just a little bit more attractive, and we've seen a bit of recovery in the rand. Recently, it's also going to be something that is going to be affecting tourism and manufacturing because of the numbers that have come out of South Africa and China, just pointing to a downward trend on that end. In terms of his outlook, there's a lot of leadership challenges that he's just highlighting, appealing to say that you know, leaders need to have just execute on some of the plans.
This is
Mudiwa's Take. Finance Minister Tito Mboweni really has a tough job, like, ahead of him. 2 weeks, you've got a lot of data coming. You've got Stats SA telling you that the recession is, you know, I guess going forward, we're now in recession. At the same time, you've got the very tough budget. At the same time, you've got March 27, you've got Moody's that's coming out with its ratings, a declaration for South Africa. It's not looking good right now for the South African economy. But I guess outlook-wise, one of the things I appreciated about what Safis was talking about is that just highlighting the fact that there's a lot of leadership that's actually needed right now. You know, instead of politicking or having a lot of plans that sound good in theory, but execution is a bit tough. A lot more just needs to be done to make sure that the South African economy grows. And then the other one is just that disparity between, I guess, internal measures of economic growth and outlook versus where the international community is actually seeing it. Because what baffles the mind is simply the fact that South Africa has the most developed economy on the African continent, yet you've got regions that are growing at maybe 5-7%. If you look at what's going on in East Africa, for example, granted it's off of a somewhat low base, but for the most developed economy on the continent, you'd think that as an emerging market player, especially with such a liquid currency and such an active bond market, that getting interest in the economy, getting investment, getting more companies to come in, getting spurring more business development and growth would be a somewhat easier task. But I guess this and everything that's happened over the last year and all of these different economic indicators that come out is just an evidence of lack of policy implementation at the end of the day. So that's been it for today's episode. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Life, that is under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter, hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free. That's on Noyono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. And thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.